in politics what he couldn't achieve in military or in the battle. So he cannot. If you want to impose your terms on politics, on the country, you must have shown something in the battlefield, yeah, which is totally, totally the opposite. So you cannot impose that. And even the Lebanese government, who shows lots of, let's say, optimism on achieving a ceasefire, they cannot accept what Amos Hochstein wanted to achieve for the Israelis. So they couldn't, because they will be very embarrassed, and that will be very humiliating to them even. And so he didn't give them at least something to talk about.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Lebanese politicians,
yes,
the Lebanese government, by opening the airspace and the maritime space and the ground space for the Israelis freely to control
this
the country,
terms, yeah,
and to go in and out as they understand that might cause something dangerous to the Israeli government or the Israeli army. That was not acceptable by anyone.
Exactly.
Even Samir Jarjah said these terms cannot be accepted, because this is kind of a violation to the Lebanese, sovereignty.
Well, I do want to move over to a country who is also defending their own rights, which is Iran, as we know. The Iranian officials yesterday actually vowed on a powerful response to the Israeli aggression on their country. Last week, that targeted military sites, as we know, killed four of their soldiers. And also the commander of the Iran's Revolution Guards, Major General Hossein Salami, also threatened Israel with a response that will surpass all expectations. The situation at the moment between Iran and Israel, I mean, some people were questioning whether they're going to respond limited as Israel did, but it doesn't seem so, does it?
Well, that's why they used all those dirty medias,
yes,
to propaganda against Iran. They want Iran to go according to their wishes. Iran is a large country, is a very strong player in the region.
Independent.
And independent. And it's on top, and the most important, is a revolutionary,
yes,
government.
Of course.
So it's not just any government was appointed or elected by the American embassy support or the British support. It's totally out of this control. So we can say that Iran is the only country who is created, the people of Iran created their own government, and they have chosen their choice. So in electing or developing their own system.
Yeah.
So that's why they are not very happy with what's going on, because they are used, especially the Europeans and the Americans, they are used to deal with Muppets.
True.
Go with their wishes, obey their orders, and doing what they are, you know. If I want to be very clear, they are used to deal with kind of slaves, you know. Just the slave will not discuss or will not regret any kind of orders coming from their masters. So can they master Iran? So far, what they have seen from the last attack, that the Iranians are capable on destroying Israel totally. Iran trying to avoid a major conflict in the region, because that will lead to a third world war, and
exactly,
this is consequences is very, very heavy and very big, and luckily trying to avoid that kind of a regional war, but it's not willing to back up. They will not retreat. They will stand to their rights and to the existence of the and support of the revolution or the resistance parts or or parties in the region, they are helping us or helping the Yemeni to protect their own dignity.
Exactly.
You know, what's going in the south, the people there, the fighters there are not defending the Iranian land, are defending their own land. Iran is far geographically from the Israelis. So if this is what they don't understand, why Iran support or back up the resistance movements, and this those where comes the media, the dirty media, which trying to say that the fighters in the south are defending Iran. I mean, Ayat al-Shaab in Khiam is not an Iranian village, it's a Lebanese village.
Yeah.
And the people who are fighting there, it's they are defending their home, their house, they're defending their land. It's not defending, it's far, if we want to call it that way. So you cannot, I know it's a poisoning media using Al Arabiya or even MTV in Lebanon, and now we can say that Al Jadid is also have joined this poisoning media. I'm sorry to name them, but it's we should know,
yeah,
that, and the audience should know, that those media are poisoning the minds of the people, are twisting the truth against the resistance.
So Iran, like you're saying, as certain media outlets have said, even U.S. and Western media specifically have said that Israel has a right to defend itself. In this case, Iran has a right to defend itself, and it's simply carrying this out.
This is if you want to be fair in your scaling.
Yes.
So the Israelis have the rights. Don't we have the right?
They're the only ones going according to international law.
Exactly. So according to your international law, which,
yes,
is, you know, you created, you wrote it down, and you went by this law, we have the same rights. Aren't we allowed to defend ourselves? So the question remains to be answered.
Exactly. Well, we have around 30 seconds, and I do want you to briefly answer. There has been an updated partnership agreement between Iran and Russia emphasizing defense cooperation. Could we indeed see more action from Russia in the area?
Well, Russia and China also now is did the first step by warning the Israelis from attacking their brigades and UN force in the south.
Yes.
So that's what stopped the Israeli from again, attacking the UN in,
yes,
the south. And also Russia knows by forming the BRICS countries, it's also another step to be freed from a single controller of the world,
so
and ruler.
Yes. Well, with that, I'm afraid our time has run out. I'd love to thank my guest, as always, Mr. Rizwan Razit, political analyst.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
فقه و جورسپروденс is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Stay tuned.
دیدیم در عمرمون کسانی که تواضع داشتن اینها ترقی کردن امام
We have seen many people who have shown humbleness and reached a high status. One of such people was the late Imam Khomeini. Why is his name everywhere? Because he was humble. The name of Imam Khomeini is still remembered in the Nofelu Chateau in France. Why? Because Imam used to send even the Christians over their gifts at the birth anniversary of Jesus Christ. This was how humble Imam Khomeini was.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
امام با این همه سر صدا فرمودن به من یک خدمتگزار بگین بهتر از اینکه رهبر
Imam Khomeini asked the people to call him a servant and not a leader. And he used to say that he did nothing special, but all know that what he did was very special for the people. He would rather say, the barefooted did the Islamic revolution of Iran and not me. This sense of humbleness of Imam Khomeini made his name great during all of history, all across the world.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Israel Watch welcomes you. Today we will discuss the developments of the aggressive war in Lebanon, the failure to achieve its objectives, and Hezbollah's ongoing targeting of extensive areas in occupied northern Palestine. Additionally, we will touch on the economic losses faced by the Israeli economy due to this conflict. Joining us in the studio to explore these topics is Mr. Hassan Azzain, an expert in international relations. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Let's start by discussing the significant losses that Hezbollah is inflicting on the Israeli officers and soldiers in southern Lebanon. This situation has caught the attention of the Israeli media, raising questions about the effectiveness of continuing this war aimed at breaking Hezbollah, which one former Israeli general has described as an impossible task. Mr. Hassan Azzain, let's start with what the former Israeli general in the occupation army, Nimrud Sheffer, mentioned. He highlighted the severe losses that the occupying forces are suffering, both in terms of lives and military equipment.
The reported figures indicate that there have been 90 dead and 900 wounded, amounting to approximately 1,000 casualties. We're talking about 1,000 casualties between dead and wounded in the course of 1 month, or a little less than a month. This period coincides with the ground operations in Lebanon. The number is exceedingly high, particularly given the limited geographical area where the fighting is taking place. We're discussing only a few kilometers and occasional incursions, sometimes less than a kilometer into what is referred to as the front line. The intensity of these figures was unexpected for the enemy, who were taken aback by Hezbollah's resilience despite the extensive bombardment of villages, which reportedly involved 900 airstrikes on a single village over a few weeks. From a military perspective, this level of engagement is unprecedented. Nevertheless, Hezbollah managed to inflict approximately 1,000 casualties on the enemy. This figure is significant when considering the objectives and costs involved. While some villages have been partially destroyed and claims have been made about neutralizing threats, the ongoing battles raise questions about why the fighting continues to this day. This situation has led to a retreat from their initial goals of reshaping the West Asia and reaching Litani and disarming Hezbollah. Now, with current negotiations with Pakistan, we hear that they're suggesting that Hezbollah should only pull back a few kilometers and that there should not be any armed manifestations in Litani.
Mr. Hassan Azzain, it is clear that General Nimrud Sheffer understands well the current state of the occupying army, which is unable to sustain a prolonged war of attrition against Hezbollah. However, the obvious question arises, why does he continue this conflict under Netanyahu's leadership?
Yes, there are two key factors for Netanyahu. First, we're approaching the American elections, which are just about a few days later. He's eager to negotiate with the new administration, whether it's the new Democratic administration under Kamala Harris, which is a continuation of Biden's, or the administration he prefers, which is Trump. Trump is likely to offer him his plan, known as the Abraham Accords, focusing on normalization without heavy interfering in Israeli affairs. In fact, Trump has expressed a desire to expand Israel, which implies increasing settlements. He aligns more with right-wing perspectives and shows little interest in a two-state solution. Therefore, anything Netanyahu has done over the past year has been in anticipation of these elections. He mentioned back in early October during the Operation Al-Aqsa flood that he wants to remain in power until 2025. So he has indeed been consistent in this regard, and the current discussions about negotiations seem more like an electoral announcement rather than a serious agreement, in my opinion.
Mr. Hassan Azzain, regarding the first speech by Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem, who described the ongoing war as the Battle of the Mighty Warriors, what does this specific term indicate?
Yes, this is a verse from Quran that speaks of possessing great might at first. From our understanding of the Quran and the Sunnah, this will definitely happen. And it refers to the idea of the establishment of Israel and a state for the Jews and the children of Israel, which will lead to their dominance. But after that, eventually there will be downfall. Sheikh Naim, who comes from a Quranic background and is well-versed in the Holy Quran, chose from this holy book the term great might at first. While some may refer to it as a strong group, the term Ul al-Ba'th is often used in the context of the enemy's terminology regarding the so-called foolish battle and the issues surrounding Israel. In reality, Israel is quite weak. Without its air force and advanced intelligence, it has not demonstrated true strength on the ground, a fact acknowledged even by their own experts.
Okay, referring to it as the Battle of the Mighty Warriors, how will this title impact the battlefield moving forward?
It certainly reflected significantly on the battlefield. We are now in the first month and approaching the second month, with Hezbollah's activities increasing daily. The scale of losses for the enemy is also growing. In response, the enemy has begun discussing the possibility of ending the ground operation. They attempted to find a new route in the Khiyam area, thinking they could advance towards the Wadi al-Hujair, but they encountered strong ground resistance and had to retreat. Currently, the enemy is facing a tremendous setback. Even military experts, both Israeli and non-Israeli, have noted that Hezbollah was not even required to take such measures. In military strategy, one can often allow the enemy to advance, but Hezbollah has not permitted them to move more than a few hundred meters and, at times, just a kilometer in order to lure them in. Hezbollah has demonstrated remarkable bravery on the battlefield, acknowledged by both friends and foes. Initially, I heard some Lebanese analysts claiming that Hezbollah was lost and disorganized, but now they all recognize that Hezbollah and the Islamic resistance have proven to be an unbeatable force on the ground, truly masters of the battlefield. While it is undeniable that the enemy has an advantage in the air, Hezbollah's drones continue to operate across all occupied Palestinian territories.
We will specifically address this topic, sir, but for now, let's shift our focus to the failure to achieve the declared goals of the war on Lebanon. This failure has led many within the entity to question the effectiveness of Netanyahu's actions in this conflict. It has also prompted those in the north to wonder about the promises of their return, especially as their numbers continue to grow daily due to the expanding range of Hezbollah's missiles and drones deep into Israeli territory. Mr. Hassan Azzain, it's a valid question that is being asked among Zionist circles, including settlers. What is the purpose of this war if it has not yet achieved its goals? How do we respond to this issue of the persistent failure to meet the stated objectives?
I read some analyses from some experts suggesting that we are now compelled to pursue a political settlement of the war. Why? The drones are sweeping through occupied Palestine and can even reach the residence of Netanyahu, striking various bases in Tel Aviv and its suburbs, as well as in Haifa. From this perspective, they have clearly failed. Additionally, rockets can be launched from the north and south of Litani, from the Begah Valley, and from virtually anywhere. Currently, the Zionists claim that they have only managed to reduce the threat of anti-tank missiles, which have a range of 10 kilometers. This is certainly misleading. If they move 10 kilometers away, they might think they're avoiding the threat. But if they get closer to areas like Khiyam or Kafr Qila or even the security perimeter near Palestine, they will still be vulnerable to these rockets. Just the other day, Almaz missiles targeted tanks. The enemy, for the first time, is questioning, why are we producing armored vehicles and tanks then? Because they now know that these tanks will end up scrap metals, and yet they're advancing with a few commandos in small groups, followed by a huge amount of fire support.
It's clear, Mr. Hassan, from the Israeli commentator's remarks that preventing this bombing and the infiltration of Hezbollah members are impossible. How do you assess this statement?
Naturally, Hezbollah continues to engage in the ongoing conflict, as many leaders from various councils, including those from Galilee, have stated that they will not return to the region unless security is assured. Currently, security remains uncertain as Hezbollah retains the capability to interoccupy Palestine at will and can launch missiles and drones and explode cars whenever it chooses. This has led to significant confusion among the enemy forces, particularly in recent days, which have brought numerous surprises, including the enemy's retreat to a point where they are seeking an agreement, even if it is merely to implement the 1701 resolution with a specific execution mechanism. The developments of the past weeks were quite different. While there is no definitive assurance that Hezbollah can interoccupy Palestine, there is also no current decision from Hezbollah regarding this matter due to various tactical and non-tactical reasons. Therefore, the statements made by these commentators are accurate in assessing that Hezbollah has disrupted the Israeli equation they intended to establish.
In this context, a quick resolution to the war in Lebanon is unlikely, and the Israeli conditions promoted by the Americans will not be acceptable to Hezbollah, as they would amount to surrender. This is a belief that many Israelis and commentators in the Hebrew media are increasingly coming to accept. What can you tell us about the nature of the negotiations that are reportedly being conducted by the Americans? Also, what is the truth behind the impossible Israeli conditions that Hochstein brought to Lebanon?
Certainly, yesterday we heard the statement from the White House spokesperson indicating that there are several drafts in circulation. Therefore, one should not rely on these drafts presented in Israeli newspapers or elsewhere. Lebanese Speaker of Parliament Nabi Berri and Prime Minister Najib Mikati have both affirmed that the proposal is strictly in accordance with the implementation of Revolution 1701 without any additions or omissions. This sentiment has also been echoed by Sheikh Naim Qassem, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, who emphasized that no alterations can be made. Currently, even Pakistan acknowledges that any modification to the resolution, which was issued by the United Nations Security Council, would require the approval of China and Russia. They are now proposing a practical mechanism, particularly concerning the northern and southern Litani regions, the military presence, and the entry of the Lebanese army. The Israelis explicitly desire certain outcomes. A crucial point is that the establishment of an executive mechanism that would allow them to monitor any arms transfers or retreatment of Hezbollah, as well as oversee issues related to borders and crossings, including the Beirut airport and land crossings with Syria. The United States has committed to this matter alongside its Western allies, asserting that Lebanon cannot accept the presence of the Israelis. Meanwhile, there are the British and German forces present. The Germans have ships patrolling the Lebanese waters, and the British are stationed at the borders. So nothing has really changed. It feels like we might find ourselves in the year 2006, facing the same conditions, and the enemy could even be less formidable.
It is clear that Benjamin Netanyahu aims to impose surrender on Lebanon and Hezbollah, which is, of course, impossible. So what are Netanyahu's intentions regarding the war on Lebanon?
Yes. Netanyahu has certainly fallen short of achieving his ultimate goals. In the first 10 days, he delivered some very strong blows to Hezbollah, without a doubt. This effort is the result of 18 years of work from 2006 to 2024, during which they compiled a significant target bank. Unfortunately, this was largely due to the technological superiority they possess. They launched these strikes in the initial 10 days from the pager explosions to the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, believing that the path was clear for them. They even hoped to advance as far as the Litani River. The Israeli perspective has been focused on this since the beginning, even Smotrich had mentioned it. However, they were taken aback by the defensive capabilities established by Hezbollah and the brave fighters who stood their ground. We have martyrs and wounded, and our fighters sacrificed their lives to establish this balance, which thwarted the enemy's goal of penetrating deeper into Lebanon.
Mr. Hassan Azzain, Hezbollah's drones instill fear in the Israelis, prompting Netanyahu to keep his movements under wraps to avoid being targeted again. How do you interpret the impact of Hezbollah's drones on the Israeli entity, and what effects have they had?
I recently saw a picture of Netanyahu inside the Knesset, seemingly looking up at the ceiling. One of the commentators remarked on what he might be gazing at, suggesting it could be Hezbollah drones. This topic was brought up by Netanyahu during a cabinet meeting, where he emphasized the need to reconsider how these meetings are conducted, as they shouldn't be exposed. Additionally, Netanyahu's wife expressed concerns about their safety, even while traveling. She was, of course, afraid that even while they were on the plane, she would be hijacked. This fear has led them to request $500,000 to enhance security measures at their home in Qasariya. There are several indications that he has experienced psychological distress, and it seems this situation was anticipated. At the time of the drone attack in Qasariya, Netanyahu was there. It seems that he was in the house and they did not want to leak this point. He was warned half a minute or just a minute before the drone hit his residence. The unexpected downing of the drone caught everyone off guard. Even Sheikh Naim Qasim mentioned that representatives from Western countries contacted Hezbollah, stating that their actions were unprecedented, as they were effectively killing the head of Israel, who is immune. And of course, Sheikh Naim Qasim responded clearly, pointing out that if they can kill our leader, do they not regard others with the same seriousness? Netanyahu, of course, wants security for himself, because he does not feel safe anymore. He is the type of a leader who seeks his own interests. He tends to be narcissistic, which has led him to experience fear, and this is certainly a significant matter.
Expert in international relations, Mr. Hassan Azzain, thank you so much for joining us in this episode of Israel Watch. Best wishes until we meet again, and take care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the United States, federal authorities are investigating fires at two ballot boxes in the Portland, Oregon area that destroyed hundreds of ballots. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. CNN, cable news network, has covered this story and tells us more. Federal authorities are investigating fires at two ballot boxes reported on Monday morning, 28th of October, in the Portland, Oregon area that destroyed hundreds of ballots at one location, as well as another fire reported earlier this month. Evidence from the incendiary devices found at the ballot boxes on Monday showed the fires are connected, as well as a third incident reported in Vancouver, Washington, on 8th of October, according to Mike Benner, a spokesperson for Portland Police Bureau. While many of the ballots in Portland, Oregon were unaffected, hundreds of ballots were destroyed in a Vancouver ballot box, according to election officials. Portland police also identified a suspect vehicle seen leaving the scene of the fire in Portland, which is believed to be tied to the two incidents in Vancouver, Washington as well. They said in a news conference on Monday, the car appears to be a black or dark-colored 2001 to 2004 Volvo S60 that's missing a front plate and has an unknown rear plate. Portland Police Bureau Assistant Chief Amanda McMillan, speaking at a news conference on Monday, 28th of October, said, "We don't know the motives behind these acts. Sounds like a series of three at this point, but we do know that acts like this are targeted and intentional. We are concerned about that intentional act trying to affect the election process. We're dedicated to stopping that kind of behavior, and we're working towards that today." Meanwhile, the FBI is running a separate but parallel investigation into the matter, according to Mike Benner. The agency's Seattle office confirmed to CNN they're working on the investigation. The governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee, said in a statement on Monday, "There will be 24-hour enhanced security around ballot drop-off locations." While law enforcement investigates this incident, we urge concerned Vancouver area voters to check with the Clark County Auditor's Office or the website voteswa.gov for accurate information about how to obtain a replacement ballot or track their ballot once it has been returned. There are multiple ways for voters to cast their ballot and make sure that their voice is heard. Police responded to a call about a fire in Portland, Oregon about 3:30 a.m. local time on Monday, 28th of October. An incendiary device was attached to the side of the box and security personnel extinguished the fire, according to officials. Police previously said the device was placed inside the box. While three ballots were damaged, 409 ballots were protected by fire suppressant inside the box, according to Multnomah County Elections Director Tim Scott. A second ballot box was set on fire early on Monday morning at a bus station in Vancouver, Washington, according to Vancouver Police Department. When police officers arrived, they found a suspicious device next to the box, which was smoking and on fire. Laura Shepherd, a spokesperson for the City of Vancouver, Washington, said election officials are asking anyone who may have placed a ballot in the box after 11 a.m. on Saturday to contact them to check the status of their ballot. Election officials are still counting all the ballots involved in the Vancouver fire, but believe hundreds of ballots were destroyed by the fire, according to Clark County Auditor Greg Kimsey. Greg Kimsey said some were damaged and might be able to be duplicated and then processed. Some were severely damaged and some were completely destroyed by the fire. An incendiary device was also found at a ballot box in Vancouver, Washington on 8th of October after someone called to report that the ballot box was smoking. Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs condemned the fire and confirmed some ballots were damaged. "We take the safety of our election workers seriously and will not tolerate threats or acts of violence that seek to undermine the democratic process," Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs added. "I have complete confidence in our county elections officials' ability to keep Washington's elections safe and secure for all voters." NBC News has also covered the same story. Ballot drop boxes in Portland, Oregon, and neighboring Vancouver, Washington were set on fire on Monday morning, 28th of October, in what authorities believe are connected incidents about a week out from Election Day. An identical Volvo was spotted at both scenes, and the use of an incendiary device in Portland was similar in nature to what occurred in Vancouver, Washington, the city's police departments confirmed. Portland police described the act as targeted and intentional. Three ballots were damaged in Portland, Oregon, while potentially hundreds were affected in Vancouver, Washington, according to local officials. The Portland Police Bureau said an incendiary device was placed inside a sidewalk ballot box in the Central City District. By the time officers responded to reports about 3:30 a.m., security personnel in the area had extinguished the flames. Officers determined an incendiary device was placed inside the ballot box and used to ignite the fire. Portland police added that the Bureau's explosive disposal unit removed the mechanism. Portland police were continuing to investigate the incident. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office said it would step up patrols around ballot drop boxes in the county. The Multnomah County Elections Division said in a statement that fires are present inside the ballot box protected virtually all of the ballots. Voters should be assured that even if their ballots were in the affected box, their votes will be counted, the statement read. Around 4 a.m., in the early hours of the morning, about a half hour after the reported fire incident in Portland, police in Vancouver, Washington responded to a ballot box fire. Flames and smoke could be seen coming from the ballot box near the Fisher's Landing Transit Depot. Vancouver police said officers arrived to smoke and flames and found a suspicious device next to the ballot box. The fire was put out and the city's Metro Explosive Disposal Unit collected the device. The FBI was investigating and no further details were immediately available. Clark County Auditor Greg Kimsey said potentially hundreds of ballots could have been damaged in the fire. He added, people who placed ballots in the box after 11 a.m. on Saturday should contact the office to confirm the status of their ballots. Shasti Conrad, the chair of the Washington Democratic Party, said she expects Greg Kinsey and law enforcement to find those responsible and hold them accountable. Authorities have not ascribed a motive for the incident. The incident comes as election officials across the county have said they're on high alert. For many localities, once routine election business has become a security challenge.
In 1947, Palestinian land, rich with its culture, history, and civilization, was officially divided by a United Nations resolution. However, the terms of this division were unclear. Despite the Jewish population being smaller in comparison to the Muslims, more land was allocated to the Jewish community. Additionally, it was decided the Al-Quds should be administered internationally. It was also another issue that wasn't clearly defined. In reality, the United Nations plan and program were not feasible. Thus, Britain refrained from overseeing the distribution of lands. The situation in Palestine is shrouded in ambiguity. Arabs and Jews are prohibited from residing in each other's territories. Ostensibly, the right to visit the holy sites is supposed to be preserved for all, but the Zionists did not have a good track record in this regard and were not trustworthy. They were colonizers, speaking only of land acquisition. The Palestinians remained bewildered and confused. They are left in a state of perplexity. They cannot believe the events that have unfolded. The Zionists have become co-owners of their land with a resolution, and they have the larger share. Britain, as the ruler of Palestine, served the Zionists and suppressed the Muslims. The United Nations resolution had no enforcement guarantee. The clauses of the resolution were also vague. The future was uncertain. Tensions escalated rapidly. Muslims came under attack. Some Palestinians were forced out of volatile areas. However, tensions were not subsiding. Conflict gradually engulfed all of Palestine. Security dissipated. Murder and looting became rampant, as if the Zionist attacks were orchestrated. The Zionists sought to seize properties and assets, even by force. This is why they attack Muslims everywhere. They aim to seize everything through threats and intimidation, even Al-Quds. Following the escalation of conflicts, thousands of people became refugees. This is not something to be overlooked. In 1948, the invasions flared up. Palestinians resist as much as they can. Abdul Qadir al-Husseini, a revolutionary commander, sets out to fight back, but he is empty-handed. He lacks sufficient weapons and ammunition, and worse, he is not supported. Abdul Qadir al-Husseini is a seasoned warrior with a history of fighting, knows that Al-Quds is the focal point. He rises to protect Al-Quds. America practically supports the Zionists. Menachem Begin, with a long history of criminal activities, comes into play and changes the course of the war. He is looking for an opportunity to frighten and drive away everyone at once. Among all the areas, however, one village has a special characteristic. The village of Deir Yassin near Al-Quds. Deir Yassin was strategically located on a hill, but despite its elevated position, it was easily accessible. Begin's plan was prepared, and a group of the most ruthless individuals was selected. The attack on Deir Yassin began. In the midst of the conflict, Abu Qadir al-Husseini, who had just returned from a journey, was martyred. The Palestinian fighters came under pressure, but resisted to the best of their abilities. For the Zionists, the war with the Palestinians was more difficult than laying bombs in the streets or at the markets. This led them to use artillery. The attackers closed in on Deir Yassin. Few defenders were quickly killed. The Zionists, with a long history of using explosives like dynamite, blew up the homes of the Palestinians with the inhabitants inside. Then they announced over loudspeakers that people could leave the village. Escape as soon as possible and save your lives. Those who survived slowly left their homes. The Zionists became even more ruthless, committing a massacre of the people in the most horrific manner possible. The atrocities that occurred are unimaginable. Reports left behind speak of bitter and heartbreaking events. At 10 o'clock in the morning, I visited the Palestinian village of Silwan. No one was willing to speak. They were ashamed. Women, girls, and even elderly women have been subjected to assault and rape. Girls have been mutilated. Infants have been slaughtered. Elderly women have been beaten with rifle butts. In another report from Red Cross representative, it is stated they have thrown the bodies into a pit. A pregnant woman has been shot at close range. The trace of the bullet is still on the woman's clothing. A young Zionist girl shows me a large blood-stained knife. She is a member of the cleanup team. they are killing the wounded. I forcefully entered a house. The house was brimmed with bloodied corpses. I heard a noise. A 10-year-old girl was alive among the bodies. They had cut her wrists so she'd bleed to death. The language is short of telling the rest of the crimes. In the continuation of the crimes in Deir Yassin, they put some Palestinians as prisoners behind the trucks. They take them to the city of Jerusalem and spin them around. Then they return to Deir Yassin and massacre them all. The number of victims is never determined. The reporters, who a few days later, after the crime scene is cleared, enter Deir Yassin with delay. However, the news of the incident quickly spreads throughout all of Palestine. People become frightened, terrified, and flee. This is exactly what the Zionists wanted. The British closely monitored the situation. They looted the remaining belongings of the people and erased the traces of war. Finally, Britain announces it will withdraw its forces from Palestine. The Arabs are taken by surprise. The Zionists, aware of all the details and events, seize the opportunity. They declare the formation of Israel within the land of Palestine in a meeting. America, as the first country, recognizes Israel officially. Wiseman writes, it was the resistance of the Palestinians that delayed the implementation of the plans. After the departure of Britain, the Haganah seize the leftover weapons, and some of them become members of the police to supervise the security and property of the people. This was done in Moshe Dayan's way. He shook hands with the Arabs in the morning and attacked them at night. As tensions boil over, Palestinian villagers are evacuated one after another. Palestine is heading towards destruction. Muslims are getting angry. The flames of war are ignited. Arab armies move towards Palestine in the form of a rescue force. At first, Arabs succeed in advancing. However, the United Nations quickly intervenes and declares a ceasefire. The war comes to a halt. Israel rapidly imports weapons and ammunition, changing the battlefield. The war is lost, and liberated lands are once again occupied. The Arabs are defeated. According to historians and researchers, in 1948, a genocide occurs. There is no exact figure, but at least 13,000 people are killed. The victims are buried in mass graves, and many bodies have been hidden by the Zionists. Out of 1 million Palestinian Muslims, over 750,000 become refugees. Gradually, other Palestinians are also forced to leave their homes and shelters. The poor and the rich all become refugees.
We have to understand what happened in 1948. Imagine, half of the population of the country was forcefully expelled. Half of the villages of the country were destroyed. Half of the towns were demolished.
In the midst of all regions, a village has a strange situation. The beautiful village of Tantura by the sea. The people of this village were in a good situation and happy. They too are forced to migrate because a bitter incident has occurred. The Zionists besiege the village of Tantura. They separate the men from the women. They abduct a girl from the population. The girl's uncle complains. They immediately kill him. In the same vicinity, the girl is brutally raped. Then they drag the men to the barbed wire fence and systematically kill them. In this village, genocide also takes place. In other areas, the situation is the same. Murder and looting are rampant. The fate of the people is uncertain. Those who remain endure immense hardship, sorrow, and grief. Forced migration begins throughout all of Palestine. The traces of tears remain. A civilization is on the brink of destruction. The land is being usurped from its rightful owners. Thus, the 14th of May, 1948, is named the Day of Catastrophe or Nakba. After the people's migration, those who have nowhere to go remain in occupied areas and experience life under Zionist rule. These individuals are known as the 1948 Arabs. They witnessed the massacres of 1948. Gradually, immigrants enter. They seize the properties of Muslims and take whatever is left as their own. They plunder and take over everything. In the 1950s, the Egyptian government decides not to renew the treaty with Britain for the control of the Suez Canal. This is a prelude to confronting Israel. Britain cannot tolerate this and attacks Egyptian forces. In 1956, the Egyptian government nationalizes the Suez Canal. This is a rational move and Egypt's taken its decision. 3 months later, Britain, France, and Israel prepare for war. The war begins with Israel's attack. With the resistance of the Egyptians and international actions, the war quickly comes to an end. Of 1956 does not bring any achievement for Israel. The fire smolders under the ashes in 1967. Israel suddenly attacks Egypt. The Egyptian army is caught off guard. What the Egyptian forces are doing, though, accompanied by great courage, does not lead to anything. Egyptian soldiers are besieged in the Sinai Desert. Israel seeks revenge. They massacre the Egyptian soldiers. After Egypt, the remaining Arab countries also suffer defeat. As a result, Israel occupies more land. The main factor in the Arabs' defeat was the support of the United States, advanced telecommunications equipment, and espionage activities. More importantly, it was the fate of Palestine, which was on the line. After the war, the area of Israel triples. Many become refugees, and the remaining people are trapped under Israeli rule. Grief and sorrow have engulfed the Arabs. In 1967, the United Nations adopted a resolution in the hope that Israel would withdraw from the occupied lands. However, Israel conditions its withdrawal from the occupied territories on the recognition of its legitimacy. This is vital to them. In response, Arabs emphasized three things: no peace, no negotiations, and no recognition of Israel. 3 years after the Six-Day War, Israel does not relinquish any of the occupied lands. They make excuses. For example, they do not return the Sinai Desert to Egypt under the pretext of Israeli security. Therefore, in 1973, Egypt and Syria launch attacks to forcibly reclaim their lands in the Sinai and the Golan Heights.